You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiya, and I've come to Faraway Lane in Hanover, New Hampshire on a very rainy day to meet with the brilliant, if reclusive, public intellectual Jack Beattie. He's senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly, a regular contributor to the NPR program On Point, and the author, most recently, of Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Jack Beattie, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
I want to jump in right away and address this rather loaded term, public intellectual, which I just assigned to you.
Yeah.
What does the word mean to you?
I think it sort of originated from the world of the Partisan Review, which when I was a young man was still, you know, the organ of intellectual skywriting, I guess. And I think it came out of that, that they were people who had expertise in particular fields. Lionel Trilling, literary critic and scholar, Sontag, or critic, or Richard Hofstadter, you know, historian, but who could at once bring to bear their professional training and transcend it in talking about current matters. And I think that they were implicitly all sort of moralists in the sense of, you know, this is the way life should be.
You are working on a book right now on the First World War.
Yes, yes.
Who were the public intellectuals of that era?
Well, Randolph Bourne comes to mind because he was so in dissent. The New Republic was started in 1912 as a vehicle of the Theodore Roosevelt campaign. And its early editors, Herbert Croly and Walter Lippmann, who was younger, and people around them, they signed on to the war, the American participation in the war. And John Dewey, who was the philosopher and educator, he expressed the thought that this was a plastic moment in history, and that to stand back and to just criticize would be to abdicate the chances of working this moment for good. And for that, Wilson himself, to be fair, had a lot of this feeling too. That's why he entered the war, really. I mean, sure, the submarines and so on, but really it was, you know, to remake the world. That was his ambition.
You've just touched on one of the key issues for me about the concept of the public intellectual, because on one level, this person has some detachment from whatever it is they're observing and commenting on.
Yeah.
They're not active participants. They're not protesters.
That's right.
And on the other level, if you have these beliefs, or perhaps that's not the right word for an intellectual, if you have this sense of what is right, mm-hmm. what is the truth, wouldn't it be almost immoral not to act on it?
Well, I think these are the kinds of dilemmas that these writers felt. And I mean, Lippmann, you know, joined the peace proceedings at Versailles and wrote things for the Wilson administration, and they defended the war. And yet, you know, Wilson won re-election in 1916 because he got the socialist vote. And the socialists and liberals and labor people endorsed him strongly because of his progressive record, and also because of his vision of peace, that the United States was not going to get involved in this war, but instead we were going to mediate, and there was going to be something like, you know, a league of peace at the end of the war. So he won the war. He won the election narrowly. In other words, he got in there only because of leftist votes. And then as soon as he was president, he turns on the left. And with the help of these so-called intellectuals, and the war just consumes the new freedom, his program.
What's fun about speaking with you, Jack Beattie, is that I have absolutely no idea where you're going to go next. And there's absolutely no way I can prepare.
Yeah, I don't know how I got here, but
I might as well put these papers down. However, I want to pull you back to the present. Mm. We do have a war as well,
yeah.
which you can reference. Who are the public intellectuals today, and are they making any kind of impact, do you think?
Well, I think it's changed. I mean, Galbraith, Schlesinger, the people that I read and who shaped my views, Noam Chomsky and George Kennan, those would be my main influences on my views of foreign policy, history, and so on, everything. There aren't people like that anymore. Pulitzer Prize winning authors who also, you know, speak to the times. There was a different tradition then, you know what I mean? There's no one like that now, is what I'm saying.
Why isn't there anybody like that right now?
One thing that happened was the professionalization of intellect. Intellect being this free-ranging, how do I have authority here? Well, I read the newspapers. But that more and more, it's a professionalization. I mean, a contemporary political scientist doesn't get points for bandying words on the radio. You know, the pressures in the academy, someone with tenure and status, probably. But even there, you know, they look down on that. It's frowned on to generate comment about the present. If you're a historian, what do you know about the present? You know, that's not your field. It's journalism. Your opinion is as good as anybody's. People didn't ask that kind of question so much when a Schlesinger or a Kennan or a Galbraith talked.
I was speaking with Richard Posner recently, who wrote the book Public Intellectuals, A Study of Decline in 2001, and he thinks things have changed pretty much since then, and there's an emergence of a new group of intellectuals, and he mentions with great enthusiasm Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I suppose. I don't really, I can't bear him.
So, well,
I think he's just a poseur.
That's exactly.
He has no stake in this country. I'm afraid to say that. He's an immigrant, but I don't feel he has a stake in this country.
His poseurness is exactly the question that I'd like to ask you about, yeah. Because if we look at the media landscape today,
yeah.
How are public intellectuals or similarly intelligent people supposed to be heard? Let's face it, Hitchens has found a way to be heard.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I mean, I think that, Josh Marshall, it seems to me, fits this mold. Now, that Talking Points memo, I think, is just superb. And his essays, which are not necessarily just news-related, that are based on the news, where he sorts through thinking and arguments made by people defending the war or sophistries and so on. It seems to me that's a superb example of the public intellectual. And I think that the young man, Marcus Melitzis at the Daily Kos, I think he's a real political intellectual. And I think that Fred Kaplan at Slate is on these security issues and on the war and on all this stuff. He is just strikes me as he doesn't just talk about the policies. That's the ebb and flow. He talks about the assumptions, the values, the vision. That's where you get to ideas.
So you've just mentioned two people who are using blogging,
yes,
to get the word,
right,
out.
Right.
There's no limit on the length of what they can write.
No.
They're not being defined by commercial television's 30-second
spot. No. And they're able to think in writing.
George Orwell. Is the name that always,
yes,
comes up.
That's right. Yeah. Now there, that's the authority of experience. You know, the authority of authenticity. That, to me, the touchstone there is that Whitman line, I am the man, I suffered, I was there. That's authenticity.
It's also passion. It's not that distance.
That's right. But a sense that he had earned it. I was just reading him yesterday about Spain and his piece on, you know, looking back on the Spanish War, and even after all the betrayal by the communists of the Trotsky anarchist revolution and the purge and all the rest, he still said that he knew it was worthwhile. And the reason he knew it was worthwhile, and here's where you come to the point that's so often missing from intellectuals. He said that he was at the front, one of the Catalonia front or something, and there was a a map spread out over a table and people were reading it. And he noticed there was an Italian man there with a creased, worn face. And he knew, he could tell that that man couldn't read and he couldn't read a map. But at the end of the meeting, the Italian looked at him and he said, "Franzos?" And he says, "English." And the Italian man reached out, smiled, no teeth, and shook his hand. And he said, and I realized this was a state of affairs worth fighting for. That this man, who had probably seen fascism at close hand, had come to Spain to fight, who couldn't read or write. This was a state of affairs worth fighting for. And that's the connection, I think, that's often lost with intellectuals. The connection with the common life and with the common people, the people who don't have the leisure to express themselves in the public prints. And I do think our intellectuals, if I were to make even a criticism of that generation of intellectuals, they were so far removed from the struggles of ordinary people. And I'm no public intellectual, but I hope, given my own background, my father was a schoolhouse custodian. He started a union. I was a member of a union for years. I do not have a college degree. I do not have a high school diploma. So I know something about the other side of life. And that's my touchstone.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with Jack Beatty, a regular contributor to the NPR program On Point. I do insist on my calling you a public intellectual, and let me show you why. I'd like to play a short quote of yours from an On Point program, the NPR program you contribute to. And the program was about the history of conversation. It was recorded in April of 2006. And here you're talking about the Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset. Let's listen.
Ortega y Gasset says that tolerance is the acrobatic willingness to share existence with another. Acrobatic, because you've got to keep leaping over your own principles.
Now, only an intellectual Jack can come up with a sentence like that. And also, it's on public radio, so you score on that front as well. To me, an intellectual is someone who brings ideas together. I think that's what you do in many ways. Your mind moves from one stimulus, it kicks off other ideas, and you create something new. Most of us are not trained to do that.
Yeah.
You said you didn't get a high school or a college degree.
Yeah.
Perhaps those of us who have lost the spontaneity and the joy of free association of ideas.
That could be. And it may be that I have the magpie, the autodidact is what I am, really. I mean, as a kid, I kept notebooks with, you know, quotes in them. And I still do. I write down things.
Now, how did you remember this quote from Ortega y Gasset?
It came from the work of a philosopher whom I know. Glenn Tinder is his name. And he wrote a book called Tolerance, and he used that in there, exploring the idea of tolerance. And I loved that when I saw it. This was, you know, 25 or 30 years ago.
So if we look at that again, you say that tolerance, you're referring to y Gasset, that tolerance is the acrobatic willingness to share existence with another, acrobatic because you have to keep leaping over your own principles. I'm wondering, are we supposed to think tolerance is a good thing in this context? It would seem that he is saying we have to lower ourselves to get along.
Hmm.
To leap over your own principles is a lot to give up.
It is, but you know, I mean, I do think that, what does Goethe say? Life is green and theory is gray. I mean, I think that principles are made to be left over. Because when it comes to human beings, there's always some difference, you know. But I think tolerance is a kind of gesture to the plural nature of truth, too. Every piece of truth is, you know, under the sign of eternity. I mean, it's not, you know, even in the sciences, things change. With the current matter in Iraq, maybe historians are going to see this entirely differently. Seems unlikely.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with Jack Beatty, the journalist and author of a new book called Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. I'd like to look at this Gilded Age. The poor, as you make very clear in the book, were really trod upon by these industrialists.
Right.
The working poor who were building these railroads, working in the steel mills, were being betrayed as well.
They were. My book is about three betrayals: of blacks, the promise of emancipation, of democracy, government of the people, for the people, by the people, and of this idea of free labor, of individual entrepreneurship, of small guy. You know, the populist diagnosis that government, that money bought out government at every level, and that then that the inequalities that were existing in the society were augmented because all the laws favored the wealthy. That was accurate then. It's even more accurate now, as a report that I cite here from a study by the Political Science, American Political Science Association, demonstrates. The report is called American Democracy in an Age of Rising Inequality. They described a system in which inequalities in political voice, I'm heard, but so is the hedge fund guy who gives $50,000. We're not heard the same. In which inequalities in political voice augment economic inequality. Campaign contributions and lobbying enable access to politicians. Access leads to voice. Voice to policy, to tax breaks, subsidies, earmarks, regulatory relief, the power to set the agenda. Meanwhile, they write, that was me, meanwhile, quote, the voice of Americans who sweep floors, clean bedpans, or collect garbage is not heard. There are many more people who sweep floors and clean bedpans and collect garbage than there are hedge fund millionaires. And in a democracy, their voice should be heard just as loudly, and it isn't.
And that's theoretically what America is, a society that values the equality of life chances, of opportunity.
Yes, but it also values money and the success ethic. And that's the other thing. In America, everything is striking it rich. And people use that word success. Oh, I'm a success. And I've even heard people say, of course, a successful man like me. And I want to say, wait a minute. My father was a successful man. He helped to start a union. He, was home for every supper in his life. He never cursed. He said grace at meals. He had to clean the vomit of school children to pay for his family, and did it, and held up his head. It was hard, but...
Let's take a small break. You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with Jack Beatty, a regular contributor to the NPR program On Point. Jack, you made an interesting comment on that same On Point program in 2006 about the history of conversation. And though you weren't referring specifically to the public intellectual, you did bring up the subject of the public man. Let's listen.
And the 18th century, it was the century of public man. I mean, people had public characters that they were going to maintain. And of course, the sincerity revolution and the authenticity revolution and so on has undermined that. But there's a lot to that, to have a public character, which means I'm going to be somewhat detached from my own views. And in that way, you can actually have some play.
Yes. What I'm saying there is that I'm actually expressing a point of view brilliantly laid out in a book in the 70s called The Fall of Public Man by Richard Sennett, the sociologist. And essentially that's what he shows, how in the 18th century there was a kind of, people accepted the public persona of someone. And it wasn't, the idea wasn't, I'm going to show you what I feel. It was, I'm going to adopt this persona here, and I'm going to, you know, as Dr. Johnson said, talk for victory, and certainly within his convictions, but there was also a kind of freedom from, and a kind of play, that authenticity denies, no, I am, this is what I really feel, and this is what I really, truly feel. George Bush is an example of this. He's feeling things all the time.
He looked at the soul.
Yeah, he feels, the trouble is he doesn't think a damn thing. He feels everything, right? Or he tells us he does. And the trouble with feeling is there's no common world there. Well, you feel it all right, but that's not... In other words, you cease talking about that out there that you both can see, the world.
Facts.
Realities. And you're looking into your feelings and in the way the romantic does. And says, oh, my God, it's what I feel about them that matters. And finally, it's private. You see, it's private. It's me and my authentic. And what I'm trying to do is not to maintain a public character, but rather to sink back into my private character, to be, you know, to let it all hang out, and you know, and so I think that's the fall of this. Essentially, the romantic movement happened. And there was a new source of authority, and the idea of adopting a public persona seemed false, and it is to a certain extent. But if you had said that to Burke or Boswell or Joshua Reynolds, they would have known what you were talking about. You know, in order to have conversation, you had to have people keeping to their public character, and not always appealing. Well, you may say that, but my feelings are really. So private and so incommunicable and I can't communicate about them even because they're so ineffable. I mean, I'm not good at...
Anti-intellectual,
yes. And when it's joined with religious views, you know, like, this is my faith, it's like, well, throw up your... Nothing more to say here. And it's the psychological revolution with Bush, you know, my feelings connected with the... with the religiosity, I think that is, I think it defines him and makes him frightening. So, but that's what I was referring to there.
But interestingly, it picks up in a way on what you were mentioning earlier in the program that we quoted, this concept of tolerance.
Yes.
Of leaping over your principles in order to communicate with people.
Yes.
Not ending the conversation once you declare your faith.
That's right. And I think that for us modern people, it's a hard slog there. You know, we have our convictions, and we belong to a culture that says, you know, your convictions are what count. Your inner experience is what counts.
But individual experiences are what shape a person's voice.
That's true.
People speak from their identity.
That's true. No, I know. But in order to get along, you've got to somehow get by that without betraying it. And I have fallen into this sincerity trap myself. I mean, at a wedding, there was a guy from, this is years ago, from the Reagan administration who was arguing that the decline in unions wasn't related to the decline in real incomes or something like that. And I nearly came to blows with him. And since he was 6'2" and, you know, a good 180 pounds, finally his wife came over and she said, "This is a wedding." But I could no more keep my identity from confronting this guy. I mean, it was like, you know, but it was totally useless, you know, in point of getting along.
Well, if you have one identity speaking to someone else's identity, that isn't a conversation. And what a lot of the discussion was in this program on the history of conversation was its decline.
Yeah.
Do you think we've lost the ability to converse?
Oh, well.
At least how to do it properly in a way that's beneficial.
I know. Oh, that's delightful.
Not a conversation stopper, but a conversation enabler.
I know. And a source of delight. It takes work, I think. And people don't recognize the social as a realm that needs work. You know, it's like, well, I'm relaxed with my friends. But you are, and you should be. But I do think the British have a better idea. You know, they strike me as people who just love to talk. and to have exchange of, and to play that way. And there isn't the trump, or at least maybe there is all the time in Britain, but in my stereotype, there isn't the trump of authenticity that would just end the conversation. You know, I had this experience. It's, well, now suppose, or, you know, put the case. And then, you know, the enjoyment of that, of that social, of the social.
But that's also intellectual.
Yes, it's intellectual. That's right.
My favorite word for this interview, as you can tell, public intellectual. Do people often tell you that you're intense, Jack?
Intense? I don't know. I mean, I probably do. You know, I do feel, I feel things when I feel them, is what I'm saying.
Perhaps it doesn't need to be said because it's so obvious.
Maybe so, but I mean, I'm not. No, you're right. I'm not casual, or I've never been able to. I'm bad at badinage, and I'm intense, I guess is right. I mean, I think that's fair. And the other thing is, it's a matter of overcoming inhibition. You know, it's like I got to get up such a head of steam to get past my Catholic youth, you know, and the children should be seen and not heard and all. It's like you've got to get so geared up just to push yourself past all that inhibition. I admire people who just, you know, can casually express themselves and feel at ease in the world. I really have to work at it that was not a virtue in our family. You know, the virtue was you did what you were told.
You don't come across that way on the radio. It comes very easily to you.
Well, in fact, it doesn't. So I'm glad to hear that. It doesn't at all, and it's this issue of inhibition and who am I, and you know, so I've got to kind of. You know, make an effort to get beyond my character almost. You know, which was, I mean, I was really raised to be a cop. You know, I mean, nothing wrong with that, but.
Well, on that note, Jack Beattie, thanks so much for the interview.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it greatly, Jenny. Thank you.
You've been listening to Jack Beattie, the author, commentator, and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, on ThoughtCast. If you'd like to leave a comment, please go to our website at thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.